Okay, we're back with Beverly.
Yes, I was saying about the Hudson High School where I teach and how much I think that there need to be more black representation of teachers and administrators in the school. And my hope is that that will occur because it's going to stop. Because especially in 2012, to have that, not to have black teachers is just sad. And it's difficult for me as a teacher there. There's not many role models sometimes. I was told the other day that a lot of teachers, they don't know how to, what to expect of me or how to take me because I'm quiet. The expectation is because I'm a black woman, I'm supposed to be loud. And I was like, wow, there is some racism going on still in the Hudson school. I've encountered that. And again, I try to find those teachable moments just not to get angry because that's ignorance. And just the other day, I was going to... we had a Regents, and this, I was supposed to sign in. I'm going to sign. It's my second day signing in. So when I was about to sign in under the teacher's list, the woman that was sitting there, she said, oh, that's for teachers. That's the list for the aides. So I looked at her after being there for a whole year, and she's an aide. She had never seen me in an aides meeting. But just the assumption that automatically that I am an aide, I was like taken aback. And the next day I said to her, and she apologized. Oh, I'm so sorry. I really didn't know. But the next day I said to her, I was really surprised that you didn't know I was teaching her after a whole year. And she again started to apologize. And I said, you could have asked. Are you a teacher or are you aide? You know, and so those are the things that you encounter, and I hope it will change. I hope that will change soon. But otherwise, I really think that I'm here in Hudson for a reason, and part of it is to really educate, to lead the way. In terms of giving vision to our young people, African-American and otherwise, because sometimes even white students, I had a situation where they thought I was teaching at Questar, and something came up and this girl told her friend that her teacher was black, and she said, what? You have a black teacher? And she was carrying on, and she was like, oh my gosh, you know, is she good? Da, 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 da. Again. And she said, yes, I have a great teacher. But after all of that, then you formulate relationships. It's just wonderful. Because I say to people all the time, it's about building relationships with the students. Black, white, green, whatever. I don't look at color. I look at you. And you're a human being, and we have needs. And if you start to formulate those relationships, building, genuinely care about them, no matter what color you are, you know, you will respond. And I've learned that to respect, because where I'm from, we have all mixed races, and we've never had to deal with that. So when I came to this country, I've had to really deal with some of that, but... I'm growing in that, and I was told, and I do know that I have very thick skin, so it doesn't bother me. Not as much, you know. So, but that is one aspect what I've observed. I've observed also that our kids, they lack the spiritual discipline. They're missing that link, spirituality. I've had a few students that ask me, are you a preacher? I said, why? Or do you go to church? you should be a preacher. You know, you because I don't know what it is, but just showing kindness. And a couple of them had asked me to come to church. I took a few of them to church with me before. But even last week, one of my former students was asking for my number, wants to come to church. But I think there's such a hunger for that. And that has to bring balance. And it's like we're educating the whole child. And that spiritual peace is also valid. And you don't see a lot of that. And so our kids are searching. Sometimes they're searching so much. And I think we have to find means of addressing that in order to educate the whole child. That's very, very important. So I do teach Sunday school and enjoy that. Me and my husband enjoy that very much, sharing time. So we do that once a month. But overall, I think that the children, they need that space to, you know, to really express that and not feel ashamed. Sometimes they're ashamed to say, you know, they know God. And I'm not ashamed. I tell them, I'm not preaching to you. I know God. So we have opportunities in our classroom not to preach the gospel, but just to talk about spirituality. Sometimes they ask, they come and ask me. I've had seniors coming just to sit down with me to ask about certain spiritual things. And I'm so glad I was able to share that without, you know, preaching. I don't do that in school or putting my religion onto them. That's not the point. But they do have questions and they do need a place where they can feel comfortable to express and to get answers to that. Because a lot of them will not get that at home. And the school, we've found out that many of them, they're hurting so much. And I'm going to bring it back to a little bit how much we have a lot of behavioral problems. Kids are acting out. And I do know that kids act what they feel. People act what they feel. So when I see a child, a student acting out, I just know that that kid is having a hard time. And so it makes me take a step back and try to understand what's going on with you. What's going on? What's talk to me. It might not be then, but I've had a student recently, just before we broke break for the summer. She was so nasty. She was like cursing back and forth. And I said to her, I love you. And she said, I don't love you. I said, well, I didn't ask you to love me, but I love you. And she's like, And she's like, I don't care. And she slammed the door and she walked out. Well, a little later she came back, knocked on my class at the room door. And she said, can I talk to you? I said, I have a class. Well, I wait 1 minute. So I went outside the door and she said, I just want to apologize to you for being mean. So, and she would come and talk to me. So sometimes, but I do know, some teachers would have written her up because she, you know, was using cursing and stuff like that. But writing them up is not the answer. And I found out that I hate writing kids up. It has to be an extreme occurrence for me to write a kid up and just to have them do detention. It's not going to serve any purpose. I've had situations where I ask to talk to the kid with the principal there, and we talked about what was happening and what's going on, why he was acting that like that. And it was a wonderful opportunity to share and to grow and to understand each other. And so that worked. But again, a lot of our students are in the school. A lot of them are hurting. They come from homes that are really, really in bad shape. No parental guidance or no parents sometimes there when they get home. And they share some of these things with you and you're like, wow. But on the other hand, I think life I've trained to really recognize that, because in 1996, I remember sitting on my front steps and just thinking about a vision, what my life will entail, what do I want most. And that's when we had just bought our first house, had a lot of room, and that's when I thought, why not foster some children? And so I pursued that, and from then I fostered over 30 kids, from the last was 2010. That was the last. My husband doesn't like it, so. And I think it's unfair. We have a young marriage, so it's unfair for him. So I'm not fostering currently. But through fostering for all those years, I adopted two. And I truly, truly understand the pain and the anguish that a lot of our students, our children are experiencing. So I can take that into the classroom and able to understand and help them, share with them. So that's my experience, you know, teaching, fostering. I've decided to go on to educational leadership. So I am currently enrolled at the College of St. Rose for that certificate. And in doing that, I think I really want to be able to connect more with the community. One thing I sense is that there's not a liaison between the school and the community. There's no trust. I've heard parents talk about not trusting the teachers. I've heard teachers talking about the no good parents. maligning parents, and you can't do that. You don't understand the dynamics if they don't understand where these kids are coming from or want to understand it. That link there is so important. If you don't understand it, then you can't teach that child. And so my hope is I can be in a, you know, work in the district office and somehow able to link the parents to the school, because we need parents in school. Every teacher in that school will tell you, oh, parents don't come to parent-teacher nights. I mean, it's embarrassing. But if the parents, they don't trust, and I keep asking, what can we do to bring these parents in? People say, you better give up. There's nothing you can do. But I cannot give up. I will not give up. I really believe that we have to educate our parents. Even the young ones are coming up now. Maybe we have a chance with them to educate them, to reach out to them, to let them see the value in education, the value of reading to their children, and also teachers to show respect or try to understand where the parents are coming from. Their environment is quite different from the middle class environment that we expect them to operate on. They're coming from a poverty mentality, most of them. And coming into an environment that is middle class in the school system. And we want them to function right away at the middle class level. Well, it doesn't work like that. So when the kids are cursing or they're talking their, you know, dirty talk, you know, we have to teach them gently or nudge them to change that vocabulary. Or we understand that's how you speak at home or in the streets. But however, when you come here, would you please do, you know. And you have to not make them feel ashamed of their language, of their culture. The street culture, whatever you want to call it. That's what they're comfortable with. So you can't make them feel, belittle them when they come to school and talking that way. And say, oh, they don't know anything. They do. They do know a lot. They know a lot about survival. And they can manipulate the system so well. And so when they come into the school system and you make them feel less than, you're not going to get anything from them. They're going to shut down. And I've seen that over and over again where the kids just shut down because, you know what, you didn't expect it from me anyway. Why would I perform for you? Because a good case in point, that you might have a student in, say, one class, an English class, and the teacher understands this child, where he's from, and respects the child, is doing great. And that same student in the social studies class is failing left and right. And you wonder why. And that kid is not doing anything. Why is it? So the hope is in the school we can have discussions, teachers from different, the English curriculum, we all can, and social studies, we all, science, we all come together and talk about how we can work with the kids. Incorporate whatever you're doing that you're having so much success, that we can do that right across the board so we can have our students really, really passing and being successful. It's a shame because I know these kids are smart because this graduation here, June 2, 2012, we had about at least 15 students that were disappointed they didn't graduate because they didn't get enough credits. And we're talking about they're all psyched. I saw one girl that I saw in the streets a week later, and she was like, I am so mad. She was one of the problem kids. She said, they set me up. She is angry. She's livid. And she said, now they're telling me to come to do, they have like workshops and review classes in the summer. She said, I'm not going. Why would I go? They should have given me those before. And I'm like, but you're hurting yourself. So I'm nudging her, But kids are mad. And it's disappointing, embarrassing, because she's telling me her friend graduated, and the friend is like rubbing it in on her. At least I graduated. So she felt less than again, a put down. So it's a lot of work. We have a new superintendent that I'm excited about, that I'm hoping that will really work. She is really serious about having some changes in the Hudson school system. And I'm excited for that because our kids, they need something better. They need more. And I'm hoping that she's the one and that I can be part of that in whatever way I can to really help to make some positive changes in this community. That's the goal. That's the dream. Okay. So.
You just used the word community, and I'm actually interested in how you feel the school that you work in relates to the larger community in Hudson.
Well, first of all, the majority of our teachers, they don't live in the community. Many of them, when it's 3:05, they're gone, an hour away. And so you don't see that connection in the community. It is very important, as I said before, to know your students, to really know where they're from, to make the effort to really go into the churches. Like I've gone to Shiloh. It's a big hub. The Shiloh Baptist Church, where the African American community, that's their center, their spiritual center. And from that, there's a lot of decision, there's a lot of connection. That's a wonderful place to start. And I've spoken to teachers, who wanted to connect. What should we do? That's a place to go. And because the word will be out. If you go to Shiloh, you saw that teacher? We had one of our principals. He always will go to services, whatever is it they're having, affairs, he will go make his face known and seen, and they respect that. So it is very important. It's a lack. you don't see a lot of her. They don't live around town. So I know there's one teacher in particular. She lives in town. And it's nice. Some teachers say, I don't want to see their faces after the day's over. If I go to the supermarket, I don't want to see them. Why not? I go and check out line and I see my former students and they come and give me hugs. I go to TJ Maxx. There is a former student coming. Oh, hi, Miss Lee. How are you? You know. And we talk about, she was actually that student. She was the most challenging student I've had. And she sees me now, she runs and she would give me big hugs because that girl, I mean, but she did a 360 degree, man. She turned herself around. And we were laughing about it the other day. I said, I told her I'm teaching a new class, a behavioral class in September. And she said, good luck. And I said, well, girl, if I could do it with you, I could do it with anybody. And she said, you got that right. And she's laughing. She said, yeah, you did. So, yeah, it's good to see them and to see how they're growing. It's awesome. So you have to want it. Have the time to really, again, is to really sincerely connect or sincerely care. One of my students, I was talking to him, and he was a little problematic kid, and I started talking to him, and he told me he wasn't living with his father. He hadn't seen his mother in 11 years, and when he said that, my heart sank because, I can't just imagine. I was without my kids for a while, and that is the most difficult thing. But his father brought him up here and left his, you know, the mom is back in Jamaica, and it's been 11 years. This kid hasn't seen his mother. So I took him under my wings, you know, and I would always bring, he comes to my class the last period of the day, and I will bring a fruit. I will have something goody for him. And the other kids will say, oh, he's your favorite. I'm like, no, we all are my favorites. But honestly, this young man, I would have something special. But that was, I just felt so sad for him. And I talked to him. I asked him to stay back several times after class and just to talk. And boy, I've learned so much. Smart kid. For his 16th birthday, my husband and I, we took him to Applebee's for his birthday. And he's like, I've never been to Applebee's. And he was so excited. They came and sang happy birthday to him. And he was like, whoa. And he went talking about it. But those things, to make it special for them. And that's one that really got to me. Those, and we have many of those students around. And other teachers, really? I said, you know, he hadn't seen his mom in 11 years. Can you imagine? And after struggle, ended up being with your father's girlfriend. They're not together. That's who you have to live with. You want to be with your family. He's like, I need some West Indian food. They don't cook West Indian food. Even those things. So you get to know them on a personal level. Get to know where they live. And then they realize that you truly care. Case in point, I always, this young man will come into my classroom, the rules, take your hat off. And for me, pull your pants up. I'm like, that's one of my pet peeves. I don't want to see your pants falling down your butt. And so as soon as he enters my classroom, boy, he's pulling the pants up and the hat is coming off. I said, thank you, sir. Thank you. And several of them, I do that. But I said to him one day, why can't you just keep it off? Keep your hat off all the time. Why do you have to, you know, as soon as you enter, you take it off, you leave my classroom, you put it back on. He said, because I respect you. I said, but you have to respect, you know, the rules of the school. Ah, no, I just, you know, but they feel safe. And I, you know, I let them know, I respect you and I expect that back. So I have a good time. I really love the kids. They will come and share with me plans, going to college and stuff like that. And that's what drives me, because I'm right now, I don't have kids at home. Me and my husband, our kids are grown. And so I think this is a wonderful place I'm at, stage in my life, really to really take some of them under my wings and just love on them. And that's giving me much joy, you know. So, but I look forward to a Hudson. Some of the kids are talking about, oh, I'm getting out of Hudson. There's nothing here. That's the other part of Hudson, man. There's not much, you know, there's a few shopping area. But in terms of places where the kids can go, there are a few places. But they need a little more places where it's that's safe, that they can really hang out. I know they have the Boys and Girls Club, but they need some more up-to-date, you know, hangout spots. And that they can do some fun things. Many of them go up to Albany and just do the mall thing. But I really think we need something, some more stuff for our kids in Hudson. I get bored myself. It's not a lot. I mean, a lot to do, except, you know, we walk around. But I can imagine the young kids being bored, you know. So we need to invest and to have more things for them to do. And I know they have a big project with the Promise Neighborhood grant, and they want to do a lot. So my hope is that will really open doors and help them bring fun activities for the kids to come and enjoy and to really grow. And that's the downside I'm seeing for Hudson. It's not a lot here. I'm talking about in comparison to Florida or even Westchester. You know, there's the skate park. They have that. That the kids can do all kinds of things, roller skating and stuff like that. They need a lot more here. There's nothing, not much. So it's limited. Then there's a little other downside, because I've spoken to a lot of the kids, and I think a lot of them are doing the pot. They are smoking because they're bored. They're smoking weed, you know. So that's a little problem we have. We need to have them be more engaged in positive things. So that's what I'm hoping. But I'm looking at a greater Hudson, a beauty. That's the vision I have, that somehow changes are coming, and that our kids will be happy to say, I don't have to get away from Hudson when I graduate. You know, I want to stay and help to build Hudson for the future generation. That's the hope. And it's funny because I moved a lot, and my kids said, Ma, are you going to stay in the Hudson area? But for some reason, I just feel I will be in Hudson for a while, because I feel that I'm called to be here. I'm supposed to be where I'm at right now, so I don't feel a need to venture out to another city, because I'm quite adventurous. But right now I'm staying put, and to see where the educational system and the community at large, I really want to see a big tie-in with the community and the school. That's on my heart. I really want to see parents coming out to those board meetings. It's embarrassing when we have the school board meetings and we don't see much parents at all. And our Black community, especially. And why is that? I remember when I was fostering my kids, one of them, she said to me, Ma, when you went to the when you went to our school parent teacher night, I was shocked. I'm like, she said, how come a black person is going to school board parent teacher night? But she said, my mother never went to those things. I didn't know black people went to those things. And I'm like, what? And again, what they expect, you know, is to change that. They're thinking and to change that. That it's not about color. It's your values. And so that is what I want to bring to them. Able to impact some change. That's my story.
Yeah, you seemed that you were very positive about the present superintendent. What kinds of programs would you like to institute at the new school or at the high school?
Yeah, the thing is, we want to see more parents, the visibility of parents in the school during the day. They have a parent partnership group that I heard about 5-6 years ago. There used to be that community, that office, that room there that parents are always there, and if there's a crisis, maybe that parent could go into a classroom and help a teacher. I want to see parents volunteering in classrooms. At least one parent in each classroom will be great. So that's a start. I really think more parents in the classroom volunteering, those kids seeing their, you know, parents in there. That's a vision that I have. And the reading program, to have parents reading to their kids. And I know our superintendent, she had the vision of having a meeting room right in the high rise, maybe bring a program right there, your pajama program, where they just have to come down to the community room for a reading session. You know, if it's once or twice a week or on Saturday morning, something where reading, it's important to get instill this in the young ones. Also, read, read, read. Readers are leaders. And I tell that to my students all the time. And they're like, I don't read. And I find that's a big problem, because when we have those Regents exams and the vocabulary, they don't know the words. How can you answer questions when you don't know what the word means? And so that is what we're having a big problem, that they're not reading. They don't know words, the meaning of these words. And so it's causing a problem. So I see where that's very important to have them. And even in the classrooms, teacher just having sessions in English class, let's formulate the circle and read. Each of us take turns. I do that with my students, and they enjoy it. Sometimes before they come in, I would set up the chairs in the circle. And uh-oh, we're going to have a session today? And it could be a session to tell me what I can do better. And tell me what is not working in this classroom. And you're in a safe place and you can talk. And so students will say, it's not fair when, you know, this one is really distracting us from learning. There's so much, you know, and they can have a safe place to talk about it. And I said, what can I do? What have I, you know, how can I improve? And it's wonderful to get those feedbacks from students. It's like, whoa. You know, but you have to be open and knowing that you're not perfect and we're here to learn together. So I love the fact that we can do that and do the vocabulary words in context when, you know, we're reading the book, not random vocabulary words. When you connect it, it gives them meaning to that. So I think those programs, having parents in the schools, and doing the reading, it is very important. As I said, readers are leaders, and it will help in all subject areas. You know, you just imagine, they don't know to read, they don't know a word, you can't, how can you do math? How can you, you know, comprehension, how can you? So, I mean, just those simple things. And a big thing is, it will help because to have the young ones respect the older ones is very, very important. And to have the intergenerational connection. Even to have, I remember in Westchester, we used to have the elderly come in to read to the little ones. And it bond. They have this bond, and the kids could see the, you know, the value of the elderly. Many times these kids don't think they're our elders are valuable, and they have such a wealth of knowledge that these young ones are missing out on. So that is very important to have that and to see, and let's glean from them. Some of them, I know a couple, the Udells, they just want to give back so much to the community. They're retired. Wealth of information, and they want to teach the kids about film, how to develop film, and coming in there and giving of their time. I think it's so wonderful. And I plan to work with them so they can help our kids. Yeah. So those are two things I think are very important.
Is there anything else you can tell me about who your students are?
Well, I teach special education. And I also taught... it's a co-taught class, so we have two teachers in our, one special ed and one gen ed. The general education teacher would be the main teacher for a subject area. So if it's an English class, she's the expert on the subject. I go in with my students. Many times you'll have a classroom of 25 students. Maybe 12 of those students are special education students. So we've tried that model when we had two teachers in the classroom. And the key is for both teachers to be on equal level in terms of discipline or lesson presentation. But what happened, I found out that wasn't working. Many times the special education teachers go in there and they don't do anything. The students look at you, oh, she's a special ed teacher. But that's just a sad waste of people's time. I felt, if I'm in a classroom, I'm the special ed teacher, but you have to know your subject area. And I find that as special ed teacher, they expect us to know a lot more. Because if we go into the social studies class, the math class, English, we have to know all those subjects. Whereas a general ed teacher, main subject, if I'm an English teacher, that's it. So it's unfair sometimes, I think as a special ed teacher, we're supposed to know everything. Anyway, so we, in a classroom that is a co-taught classroom, you'll have the two teachers and about 25 students. I've done that. And I've had a class where I teach English 15, we say 15 students, one teacher. I could teach up to 15 students by myself. I'm housed. That means I qualify to teach English or math, but I'm housed to teach English. So I will, you know, I was an English teacher for the 10th grade last year, and I also co-taught English 10. So, and I find our special ed students, and that's the population I work mostly with, very smart students, just need to go at a slower pace. Our students, and I let them know, sometimes they're like, oh, we're the dumb class. I'm like, don't ever say you're dumb. First of all, the curriculum that is being taught is the same curriculum that the general ed students are using. So it's not watered down. We are going at a slower pace. And the thing also is that we might not read 10 books. We might do 7. But the content and everything is the same. So I try to get that into their heads. And they're happy because I remember one of my students, he's very bright, but he's, in terms of his writing, is sloppy and his spelling is no good. But this kid, I just stretched him the other day and we were doing a critical lens. He had to write a critical lens about few books they have to make comparisons about the books and stuff. And he said, you know what? I have never written this much in my life. I said, but you can do it. Look at this. You should keep this here because you're talking about, you wrote about 3 pages. And he's a 16 years old. He said, I've never written this much. And his eyes are popping. It's like, whoa. But I was feeling really good because he felt good because, whoa, I can do it. I said, you see, if you try, I prodded and prodded and I got him. I said, look at you. You're smart. You can do this. I'm going to keep this for you. So, you know, again, these are smart kids. Just they need a different strategy as to how to get their point across and their time. They might need more time to complete assignments. So those are the kids, and we have quite a bit of those kids. Some of them, we know that they're not going to be taking the Regents exam, so we have a different class. But those are the kids that you make sure that they have a lot of hands-on experience. Some of those kids do project-based work. They love to, we had Black History Month, we did a lot of projects. They had to come up and do presentations, and they were beaming. I mean, they chose whoever they want to write about and do poster boards, and then some of them dressed like the person, a doctor. Those are things that it's wonderful, you know, and they feel so accomplished just doing that. So that's what our students, we have some really, really great students. We just need to let them know, some of them, to build their self-esteem and let them believe in themselves and to set the bar high. So I have a sign in my class, raise the bar, you know, and I would say to them all, raise the bar. It's when they're goofing around or, you know, being obnoxious. I would just say, raise the bar, please. And they're like, oh, senior, what do you mean raise the bar? So the other one, she means be your best. Give her your best. I said, let's raise the bar. Okay, keep it high. So they would see me in the hall and, Miss Hales, I'm raising the bar. I'm like, keep it high, you know. And so those are the relationships that, you know, you build. I do have fun with the kids. I really do. I look forward to going to work every day, expecting a miracle. That's how I put it, because they're awesome. What they, you know, and you can't hold grudges, as some teachers are. You cannot hold grudges, because every day you expect a miracle. That's my whole philosophy about, you know, educating. I taught the younger ones. I had my own daycare center for 3 years, so I taught the younger ones, and now I'm the older ones. It's amazing how, in essence, they're all the same, you know. It's just all the kids, but they just want to be loved, want to be recognized. They, you know, validation, basically, like all of us, and they thrive on that. They shine, you know. I have a lot of different quotes on the walls and stuff. And it's amazing, you see them going around just reading. Whoa. One student said, can I get this poster from you? I think it was a Muhammad Ali poster with a quote about being your best. I'm like, I said, you can come in anytime and read it. So he said, I like this. You know, but they come and they read around. They look around and read. And it's funny, I had them doing poetry. And I put their work up, and there's one student, he said to me, how come I didn't see my poem? And I'm like, he said, I gave it to you. And so they do want to see their work showcased. And I'm like, okay, I'll make sure I get it up there, you know. And I had to do that. So that's the story in Hudson, the next chapter. Looking forward to, again, being involved in the community more, as once I get my degree in this educational leadership, I'll shift gear from the classroom more into the district level and hopefully impact, bridge that gap that is so wide with the community and the school. So that's where I stand.
You think you'll miss the students?
I'll see them. I make sure, because even, and the important thing, you can still connect. You will impact them in such a broader way, in more profoundly, by getting parents involved and all of that. And, you know, But even going into the schools and making sure you're visible somehow, they still see you around, walk around. So give some time and just say hi. Connect, continue to connect with them. I mean, a key thing, I think, principals and superintendents, they need to be visible. Even as teachers, we want to see them come see us. So we have to make sure that the students feel the same way. They want to say, you know, we know their names. So even if you're not in the classroom and you can, hey, how are you doing? Call them by their names. I mean, how is your mom? They feel connected. They feel that you care. So I don't think I will ever lose that.
You've talked a lot about your relationship with the student and the relationship with the school and the parents. How about administration of the schools? Do you have anything you could tell me about that?
From my experience, I think it's lacking where administrators need to be more supportive of their teachers. And teachers, it's like everybody mind their own business. So in the classroom, I think more visibility, the administrators, is very important. If I wasn't not aware, I would say, knowledgeable about, because I've done this quite a while, so coming into a new school, you need somebody there. And if administrators are not asking you, how are you doing? Or what do you need? Checking up on you. As a teacher who's not experienced will be lost. And that is my experience there. I find that we need more of that. I remember one of our department chair, there was something that she failed to tell me. I didn't do what was required, but I didn't know. And she says, oh my, I thought you knew. You're always so knowledgeable. I forgot that you're new here. And so if there's some, first of all, they give you a mentor when you go for the first year. But if that mentor is not even in your field, why would you give me somebody to mentor me that a person's not in my area of specialty? It doesn't make sense. Because the person doesn't know, you know, anything about special ed meetings. And I had a mentor for the first year. They said, you're assigned this mentor. Oh my goodness, but what are you going to talk about if the person doesn't know what your job entails? So it was some like, whoa, wait a minute, you're not thinking this through. You're giving me a general ed teacher as a mentor who doesn't know a thing about 503 or IEPs, when, you know, stuff like that.
IEPs?
This individual educational plan with a special ed student. Each child has their own educational plan. So IEP, individual educational plan. So, and there are certain times you have to, we have meetings, and it's a legal document when you have that IEP is a legal document. So a lot of general ed teacher, they wouldn't know. So you're going to give a special ed teacher a mentor who's general ed, just doesn't make much sense. So I think they need to think that through a little more. And more support, yeah, when the new teacher's there, to give some support. I am fine with initiating things, so I'm not shy in asking for help and stuff like that, but I can just imagine a teacher who's brand new coming in, they'll be lost. So we need more of that, more visibility with the superintendent, you know, coming to our meetings, and not to have what I find. We have the school administrators, it's them against they and them. It's like, oh, central office, it's like they're always against It's not a smooth flow between the central office and into the school. And I don't think, why should that be? We're all here to serve children, so I think it should be that smooth transition going back and, or the flow of information back and forth, because we are there to help kids, bottom line. You know, it's not blaming, oh, the central office this or the central. And what is key, I've learned that since I'm in the administration program, as teachers, you look through different lenses as an administrator. So when we as teachers might be saying, oh, they don't do this, da 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 da, it's for a reason. They are not looking through the same lens that we are. So again, if information could be shared a little more freely or, you know, easily, then we don't have that, like, they're trying to hide something from us. The central office is, you know, working against us. I sense a lot of teachers, oh, it's central office, or blaming central office for stuff. It's not good. I think we need to work together. We need to work together. That is really important. And to have the superintendent or the assistant superintendent coming down and checking up on the teachers. Check, see, hi, how are you doing? See how, or the principals in this case, coming into the classroom, or, you know, just to say, see how you're doing, or giving you feedback as to how you can do things better. Not just when you have those scheduled observations, when, you know, everything is tense, you know. Just come in and check. Check and see what, well, you know, what you're doing, how you can help, stuff like that.
How about funding?
Well, I know that we don't have money for a lot of things in the school. So, and then I heard they had the after-school program. I heard they lost the funding for that. So I don't know how true it is, but they don't have a lot of things in Hudson. And so a lot of the students, we don't have a lot of choices in terms of extra classes they can take. So we have a lot of study halls. Talk about some students who have four study halls in the day. Because we don't have money to have the big, you know, other classes. They have the core classes and that's it. So it's difficult. And so when you have some students who are there for three, four study halls, I mean, they're bored. They're going to cause problems. They're not engaged. We had a lot of that. Because, again, there's not enough money to have those other classes. We cut teachers. And so we just lost our business teacher. And that was, you know, computers. The kids were there doing typing. You know, it's gone. So I don't know what's going to happen come September. So I think we lost three teachers. But with special education, we had, last year they lost some teachers too. But special ed wasn't touched because, again, by law, you have to have a certain amount of teachers to cover the kids. So that's an area that is a little bit protected.
How many teachers are there in the school?
I would think about 40 or so. I'm like 40, give and take, between 40, 50, between that 50. I'd ask that question somewhere around 40, 45 or so.
Is there a lot of cooperation amongst the teachers?
There's cliques. You have the, you know, the science department, they have the clique, the English department, and, you know. But, yeah, that's what it is. So I have one friend. I stay by myself. It's crazy. I think we need to work together, and they're trying to change that. They're aware of that intercurriculum. We need to change. I mean, instead of staying department, we need to do more sharing, you know, and it's not happening. But they're focusing on that for this new year. So my hope is that all teachers, man, whatever knowledge we can have integrated from social studies with English and work together, because I think we have a little of that starting with social studies and English, But we need to have, especially special ed teachers, it's like you're by yourself. Case in point, I was teaching English, special ed, and co-teaching English. So when they have meetings for English department, instead of me going there, I'm going to stay with the special ed department. It was, I had to bring that to attention to the assistant superintendent. It just didn't make sense. I am expected to teach the same curriculum. And when they have the meetings about curriculum planning and all of that, I'm not invited. So it's just, I was like, what? That's crazy. So I had that going on. I'm like, this just doesn't make sense. Why am I here? The special ed, when we stay together, yes, we're going to just talk about when we have our IEP meeting, our yearly annual reviews, things like that, or ways of working with the kids when they're, you know, having behavioral challenges. But if we want to teach, we have to know what the curriculum is about. What are some changes? What are some strategies? What books? Because everything is supposed to be the same. So I think that's an area that we are working on. Definitely need changing. Yeah, so. But I'm optimistic. I am. Some teachers are frustrated. And, you know, it comes to a point when you get there and you don't want to be there, you just have, you should leave. Because if you don't want to be there, it shows. The kids pick it up and you walk past some of the classroom and like, whoa, kids are on their phones, kids are sleeping. Teacher is teaching in the front of the class. I'm like, whoa, what's going on in there? So the kids are not engaged. Teacher's like, oh, I'm tired. I can't wait to leave. So that attitude, the kids pick it up. They don't care. So that's Hudson. Interestingly, you know, I'm like, amazed. I'm like, wow. It is what it is. Well, it shouldn't be like that. We have to change. We have to have teachers who have the passion. If you're not passionate about changes, making, you know, helping kids, you shouldn't be in front of them. You shouldn't. Because kids are so smart. They pick up your every move. And they use that against you.
I wonder if I could ask you about your experience as a foster parent. Is there anything that you could tell me about that?
Oh, wow. Let me tell you. Again, you have to love it. I have my motto that I live by, and it's an acrostic from my name, Beverly, in a poem form, and it goes like this. And this is what keeps me going, and it helped me in foster care. It says, Beverly, boldly stepping out day by day, empowering others along the way, victoriously winning with God by my side. Education is a passion of my heart, rallying for children for a good head start. Love, I minister to the young and grown, yielding fruits forevermore. And that's Beverly. When I think about what I do, foster care has been a tremendous journey for me. I mean, it opened up my eyes to things in the world that I didn't know existed. Because I came from a tight-knit home, sheltered. My dad was always there, loving us, going to meetings, school meetings, everything. And my mom. So I'm from a family, my mom and father, one mother, one father. They had 13 children. And so we are, the eldest one died, and it's 12 of us. And so we said we're a tribe by ourselves. And so we have always had the support of family. And so, and my mom, I think, and father always took in other people's children. Even though we had so many children, we had a big house, lots of cows, and we used to sell milk. I mean, I had a wonderful life. I used to ride horses. We had everything in Guyana. And so when I came over here and I was talking about, you know, wanting to do it, I saw my parents bringing people in our homes. I remember one occasion, we had about 25 people in our home. Uncles, sons, and cousins, and all that. And we were cooking, and this, cooking a pot of rice and peas. We called it cook-up rice. And I was amazed that it fed everybody, you know, one big pot, but everybody had food. I was like, how come 25 people ate from this? And I it brought me back to when in the Bible, when Jesus fed the multitude with the 5 loaves, I'm like, whoa, this food somehow multiplied. But I came from that family where we looked out for people, always giving. My mom was a giver. Father, quiet strength. He doesn't talk much. But everybody loved my father. He's like a rock. So when I started to foster, the love that I had for my own children, I had the same love for my foster children. And it didn't start like that. I remember, you know, he just wanted to help. But when he really sank in was one day I was taking my foster son to school. He was 6 years old. His name is Brendel. And I was driving and he's in the back. And there's a song playing on the radio, I Believe in Love. And he starts singing in the back seat, I Believe in Love. And I'm like, whoa. And something like my heart just opened up and engulfed, enveloped this kid. My heart melted. I'm like, whoa. There was no difference than the way I love my own children and the love I had for this kid. And so I just always, never, you can call them anytime, they still connect with me after all these years. Brunel, right now, he's in Japan. He became a Marine. He's 23, and he called me before he was enlisted. He went back home after 6.5 years. I fostered a group of sibling group for 2 of them, stayed with me for 6.5 years. And one of them, she didn't want to go back home. She stayed with me for 11 years. So, but she, I had contact with the mom always. I always, when I can, make sure they stay connected with their biological family. Because I found out that it's an innate desire to want to be with your own. And so what worked for me as a foster parent, whatever possible, and that kid is not going to be hurt. Even when social services said don't, I know as a mother, I had that instinct to say, get a quick phone call. Hey, hi, Ma. And so they felt secure knowing that that mom is okay. I remember one of them saying to me after he didn't connect with his mother for a long time, and I connected. He said, oh my goodness, I thought she had just disappeared off the face of the earth. And the big smile on his face when he heard her voice. So I realized, you know what, no matter what, these kids are in turmoil, not knowing if their parents, you just went there, took them. I remember the Brendel I was telling you about. They brought him and his 2 sisters. He was in a little, his sister's underwear and a tiny shirt. They grabbed them from the park and brought them to my home. Nothing. They just, and that's the hurtful, really, really terrible thing that these kids experience when they come into care. Can you imagine somebody just come into your home, yank you away, get a garbage bag, took a few pieces of clothes, throw it in the garbage bag, and just say, you coming with me. We're going, where are we going? They're not telling you where you're going. But you ended up in a suburb. Most of the time it's a nice suburb. You're taking them out from the slums. And you come to this person's home not knowing. Oh my gosh. I experienced that with my kids, how scared they were. And I always try to make them feel comfortable. I said, I know what you're feeling. Would you like to talk to your mom briefly. I remember I had, I was in the shop, one of the shopping centers with a couple of the kids, and they weren't supposed to see their mom, And boy, they saw the mom in the other aisle, and she saw us, we all, and she looked at me puzzled. They're like, and I said, come. And she came and hugged them. And then she said, thank you. And the tears, it's just emotional. I'm just going through it to understand what the kids have to go through when we take them out of their homes. It's necessary many times, but then again, you know, for those first 24 hours, I mean, you're like, wow, where am I? So I make sure I love those kids and make sure they feel comfortable. It's not easy. And you open yourself. I must tell you this. I've done it since 1994, 90. Yeah, somewhere in 94, 96, I was fostering until 2009. Always fostered. I shared that I adopted two of those children. But it came to one point, you become vulnerable when you foster, especially as a professional. And you don't find a lot of professional people fostering. Many, because I tried to recruit, I was a recruitment coordinator for an agency before. And you try to recruit professionals and they are afraid that they can get in. Listen, if somebody ever try to lie, say a lie, and then you have to go through trying to prove yourself, you know, it's not easy. And that happened to me. That happened to me up here in Columbia County. And I'm talking about Beverly fostered in Westchester. I fostered in Florida. Everywhere I go, I fostered. I was the president for the Westchester County Foster Parents Association. I worked very closely with the commissioner and all the people from the child welfare. So when I came up here, the natural thing for me also foster. So I fostered, and then for 11 months I had two boys from Columbia County. And the plan is, they're saying, these kids are going home at the end of the school year. So August through, they're supposed to go back next June, July. So like 3 weeks before the end of the school year, one of the workers said to the boys, oh, you can't go back because your mother's boyfriend, we found out he's still in the picture and there's a restraining order against the mother's boyfriend. Well, these kids, I don't know, they were really upset. They were crying. The next thing I knew, I received a call from the supervisor of the agency. She says, oh, there's a call here, Beverly. Came in from CPS that the foster boys are being attacked by, they're being beaten by the boys. Or I thought she was talking about kids at school. So I said, I'll talk to the teacher. They never told me anything. We're talking about there's no marks on these kids, you know, and these two boys are white, you know, and there's nothing. So she said, Beverly, it's not the school. The accusation is that your sons are beating them up, with hitting them with shoes, all kinds of stuff. So naturally, I said, what? I said, this mother, every week she will come to my home because they had home visits with her every weekend. She come into the yard. I allowed her to come. I told the worker. She said, we can have you take the kids, or we can take them and meet this mother. So she can come and get them. So she came in the yard. She got them. They ran out to her. She is the one that reported that her sons claimed that they were being beaten by my boys. So there's a CPS report. Oh, I'm a teacher at Questar Early Childhood Education. So the work I had, this woman who was an assistant in my classroom, she lived in my basement. She used to babysit the boys. She worked at Questar also with me. So she gave a report. The CPS worker came out to me. I gave a report. She also gave a report, you know, saying this, the boys, when I asked them why they did this, they told me they were afraid they wouldn't see their mother again, and they wanted to go back with their mother. Well, the CPS worker said, oh, it's just an investigation, da, da, da. The next thing I know, I got indicated that for neglect. Now, that goes on your record, that it affects you in jobs. We're talking about never had an incident for 11 months, not one mark on the kids' bodies, nothing. The agency told DSS, listen, that's one of our best foster parents. I mean, this woman has so much experience. No. The worker indicated me. So for 1 year, I didn't work. I was in transition. That's 2009. I was in transition when that job closed at Questar. So for 1 year, I had to fight to get that off my record. So I called when I spoke to the commissioner because they knew me. They used to come to my home because I now rent that house that I lived in at that time to one of the agency for a group home is running from my house in Ancon. So the commissioner knew me. Everybody came to the house. It was an open book. So I got indicated for child neglect. And I told you it took a year and thousands of dollars to get my name cleared. I had pastors come to the day when I was supposed to have my hearing at DSS. 24 hours before my hearing, I got a call from one of the workers, somebody there, to say, we can't have it tomorrow because we found out you have a lawyer. I'm like, excuse me? After a whole year and you had months to prepare, 4 months? I started to scream on the phone, cry, and then I hung up, composed myself, and I called back. I said, I am coming tomorrow. I have all my witnesses. I have people coming from out of town. I have letters from people from out of state. Everybody, and I'm coming with a reporter tomorrow. I said, who is your lawyer? I said, none of your business. I said, it was your place to have your lawyer. I was livid. I cannot imagine. And I could not have done that, giving them 24-hour notice to say I can't come. They made that clear in the letter. You have to give them a week's notice if you're going to change the date. But somehow they found out that I had a lawyer. So that's what I'm saying. It's so difficult. Professionals don't want to waste time. They don't want to get involved because you can get really hurt. And I can see where a person who didn't have the funds, who wasn't articulate enough, intelligent enough to know that you have to cover yourself, I can see where that person that will stay on your record and damage that person for the rest of their lives. So I had that bitter taste in terms of fostering in Columbia County. I mean, my goodness, I fostered from the cradle to high school. I had one girl. She was 17 when she came into my home. She had a 3-year-old daughter. And she was raped, and she is a product of rape. And that girl stayed with me for a year. Would you know that baby got sick within that time frame? Found out that baby had cancer. I had to be there with that little girl. Eventually, she died. And all these experiences, I mean, it's amazing. But in all of this to the end, I came up here, and I'm indicated for neglect. So the judge, I called them back. I said, I'm coming tomorrow. You like it or not? So they called me back. Oh, we found a lawyer. And the judge wrote to them. It was rescinded because he said they didn't even go by their own rules as to how you indicate somebody. First of all, it's hearsay. I don't know. I think that was my test because it was the most frustrating time because everyone knows that I have a passion for these kids. I love them. This is my ministry. And I am tested. Are you going to do this? Continue to do this? And I was asked, my husband is afraid of it, but I was asked yes, because this is what I feel in my heart to do. One of my boys that I adopted, he just returned from Afghanistan. He's a Marine. Soon as he was out of high school, he got into the Marines. I nudged him. Anyway, he's doing so well. Spent 7 months in Afghanistan. Returned in June. The biggest surprise that came to my school and surprised me when he came home. But those are the wonderful, joys you get from it. So you're going to get the good, you're going to get the bad. And I focus on the positive. I get phone calls from Brindell and his sister. It's amazing. She was in a wheelchair when they brought her to me. The three that I told you about. And we had a two-story house, and my mom used to live with me at that time. And she called me. I was at work. She said, they brought three kids, but one of them is in a wheelchair. So I said, Mom, we cannot take a child in a wheelchair. She's 8 years old. How is she going to get up the stairs to the bedroom? So my mom says, but she's so cute. She's beautiful. We'll try. And we took her, and she was one of them that stayed for 6.5 years. And you will call her, she has cerebral palsy. But she is smart as a whip, and she would call her. She's 20. She just had a 23rd birthday, and she would reminisce about the fun times and all the stuff she did. Auntie, I remember when I did something so bad, and I thought you were gonna kill me. And you just said, next time, tell me the truth. Just be truthful. She says, oh my gosh. So we have those. It's beautiful, you know. And then, as I speak, and I must say that of the two that I adopted, one of them, he ran away a few months ago. He wasn't doing well at the high school. He wanted to go down the wrong road, so I got him into Job Corps. I had him for 14 years. And I enrolled him in Job Corps, and he ran away from Job Corps. I know, so there's a missing person out for him, but I think he wanted to connect with his biological family. I did connect with him, but he wanted that lifestyle, the drugs. They're still not clean, but that's a path he needed to find out for himself. He had a lot of why questions. Why didn't they come and get me? Why they told me, oh, we didn't want to give you up, but why? So I think he's on this journey. He's almost 18, and he's on this journey to find out. And then, like that movie, Antoine Fisher, he's going to have to decide, you know, it was the best thing. My mom was selfless when actually, she didn't let him go. They took him because she was young. She was 14 when she had him. And so those are the stories. The one in Afghanistan, that's a Marine, his mother, they found her dead. She was 3 days dead when they found her with a Bible, my son's picture. And she had the needle in her arm, heroin. So those are these kids had some hard life. And you win some, you lose some. And if I could, my thing is, if I can help just one, then my life is not in vain. And that's how I look at it. I look at my son that ran away, and I pray for him. We pray for him. The church, everybody, we pray for him. He's so sweet. But there's a void inside of him that he wanted that mother, and I know how much he loves deeply, connected to his mom. He was just four when he was taken away, but those are formative years that she did bond. He bonded with his mother so strongly that he wanted, and she had five kids taken away from her. One of those children my sister adopted, And they said to me, my sister, well, you allowed him to go visit his mother, but my other sister wouldn't allow her daughter to go see the bio mom. It's pros and cons to that. Later on down the line, that girl is going to want to see her mom. And so I think I got mine early. She might be disappointed later on because, funny, she lives in Florida. The girl is in high school and she's telling me, oh, my daughter wants to come to school, to college in New York. But that's where the mom lives, you know. And I said, you know, interesting. So foster care is dear to my heart. Very, very, very dear. It's a lot of hurt going around. These kids, they didn't ask for this. And they have to put up with a lot. And so whatever we can do to help, that's what I do. Whatever little bit I can do. Because I see my son, I would take him back where he grew up, the Marine. And as soon as he gets back into that environment, his everything changes. His persona, attitude just changes. He's just got ghetto on me. I'm like, whoa. And it brings him right back to where that hurt place or that protect. He starts to be very protective and, you know, I'm like, whoa, you see a transformation just like that. So I've learned a lot from them. I've learned all how nature versus nurture, how important this environment plays in the child's life, giving them the tools to really succeed. But the bottom line is the choice is theirs. And I had that conversation with my son Ahmad. Both of them had the same opportunity. Both, you know, home lives, but one chose a different road. And so we'll see where that unfolds. I'm waiting for him to call me and they say, Ma, can I come home? You know, I totally understand. I just wish, I always told him, you can talk to me. If I have to, whatever it is, don't feel it's too hard or too difficult for me to talk. So for some reason, but he knows that I am so gung-ho about getting your education first. I said, you have to get your schooling out of the way. And he was this close, very smart young man. But the system, you know. And what can I say? People say, how do you deal with this? 14 years, that's your son. I'm like, yeah. How do you deal with it? Well, my faith has helped me tremendously. And I think all things work together for good. And I thank God for the time that He's blessed me to have him in my life. And that the seeds have been planted and that hopefully that will somebody else water and then it grows. But I know he will come back one day and remember in his heart that, you know, these are some good values and he can glean from that to help to have a successful life. And that's all I wish for him. I used to tell him, I don't want anything from you guys more than your success. Just do your best, because out there, life it's a real challenge. And my children, my biological children, can tell you the same. I tell them, you go out there, life is not easy. And a funny thing, my daughter, the youngest one, she's 25, and she said to me, Mom, her cousins, they still live at home, and they're about the same age. And one cousin, she has two children. She's a little older than their two others. That's my daughter's age. And they're saying, they wish their mom was like me, because when you're 18, if you're not in school, you be independent, you go out and face life. And I trust, you know, I told them, you can always come and have food, but go out there and you know, and enjoy. Go and see what it is like. I'll hold you up for so long, you know, but I want you to fly. I want you to go out there. And if I'm not here, then, you know, you have to face life. So she was saying, I said, girl, you pay your rent? She's like, my rent is $750, and she budgets, and that's a young one. I'm so proud of her because she's doing it by herself. My older two older ones, they're married. But she's single, and she's doing it all by herself, and her cousins, depending on their mom, and saying, we wish our mom was like your mom. Because they know they want to go, but they feel so attached, you know. But I said, to each his own. I just feel that, I guess because of how I was brought up, I mean, I said I was married pretty young, and so I was independent from a young age, and maybe that's part of it. But I will help them, but I want them to go out there and live life. And my son, Ahmad, says, Ma, you are a tough mama, but you're fair. And thank you. Thank you. Because last week he bought his first car. He said, Ma, guess what? I bought me the car you always wanted. I'm like, I drive Jeeps and stuff. He said, no, remember you wanted this car? What, you remember the type? I said, no. He said, Chrysler 300, Ma. I said, whoa, smooth ride, huh? Big car. So he just bought himself a nice car. He's 20 years old. And I'm so happy for him. I'm so happy. So that's what it's about. To help. I love to see others gain success, reach, you know, their potential, or at least on their road to success. It gives me joy to really see others because I know where I came from. I know how I struggled and I persevered. And I, thank God, you know, I'm making it, and God is blessing me each day. My grandbabies, and still young to enjoy them, so I'm very happy about that. A wonderful example is last Saturday, actually 12 o'clock. My daughter called, and she's in Alabama. She and her husband moved a year ago. So my father and three sisters were there visiting with their children and her husband. She says, Mom, you should be here. We just wish you were here. I said, well, I'm so sorry. You know, I would have liked to be there. My dad was sick, and I would have loved to see him. So she said, Ma, say the word, and I'll book your flight, and you come out. It's not too late. I said, say the word. Well, I want to be there. And she said, okay. So that was 12 o'clock. I'm on a plane at 6 o'clock. And I was in Alabama around 8:30 that night. And then she says, I wonder where I got my adventurous spirit from. And I just thank God for that. For she and her husband were generous. And they just bought me a plane ticket. I got out there. I was able to have a great time. See the grandkids, my father and my sister, one is visiting from Guyana. So it was perfect. And I said, bless their souls. That's wonderful. So I'm like, it's not in vain, you know. It's one of them will look back. And I think I have foster children. My biological children have said to me that the foster children, by seeing them in the home, that has helped them to really be grateful for what they have, because those kids coming in, they realize, whoa, kids are really, some people are worse off than they were, and that we could open our homes and share our lives with them. They became very much more grateful, and all of them, of course, they were saying, Ma, that really helped us to appreciate more. And so I think that was a good thing for them. At first, my youngest daughter didn't like me fostering. She would yell at the kids. She was about 10, 12, and the foster kids had started to call me Mommy, and my daughter got so mad. And she would say to them, she is not your mother. And she was jealous. And I had to sit her down one day and just talk to her and give her a special time, talk to her about love and sharing. And she became okay. But she wrote a letter to me one day, and she stuck it under my bedroom door. And she's like, I don't like them calling you Mommy. You're my mom. Oh, my gosh. But those are the things that when you bring force the kids into your home, the whole dimension, everything in your home shifts. So my baby girl, everything, she wasn't the baby anymore. It shifted. Our place in the family shifted, and she resented that. So I was able to, I understood, but many times people think, okay, I'm going to foster, and it's okay, and but you have to, there's so much that's going on in your home, and if you're not prepared, then it causes a lot of trouble. And so I was trained, I became a foster parent trainer. So I was able, I went to classes for that to really understand all the dynamics that, you know, that go along with fostering. It's tremendous. And my hat's off to those people who foster and also adopted. My adopted children, I mean, it's like I have two sets of kids. Because my biological kids, they're gone. And then I had the two younger, the ones that I adopted. So I had them, and I was even able to give them more than I gave my own children. More in understanding. I understood more about parenting. I had more in terms of, they had their own rooms. My kids, my bio kids didn't have that. So I was feeling guilty one day, and I called my oldest daughter, and I was sharing with her. I said, wow, I thought I've given so much more to these kids than I've given to. And she said, Mom, you gave us all that you had. And that was enough. You gave us what you had. You didn't hold anything back, so don't feel guilty. And look how God has blessed us by you opening your home to helping kids. And I felt better because it was, you know, it was hard.
I feel like you'd be an inspiration to many people, Beverly.
I just live and, I don't know, I just love.
Who has inspired you in your life?
I really, I used to butt heads with my mom, but she has, my mother had a big heart, and we were always, you know, at loggerhead. I think I'm more like her when I think about it, but she, with in terms of giving, my mom inspired me. She showed about sharing, giving. And I was always a smart kid in terms of wanting to learn more in education. From a young age, I was passionate about school, about knowledge. And I must say that I got married and then I came to this country. But I always, it's something inside of me that in terms of that drive to really do more. My mom didn't push us in terms of education. We were natural, all my sisters, you know. But something that I drive that I have, that's the educational piece. But in terms of sharing and giving and loving, that's the home we came from. That's my mom, matriarch of the family. My father's very quiet. But as I said before, he has that quiet strength. And the love, you can always go to him. And I saw my father show compassion to an older, elderly cousin. And she was sitting and she needed help to tie, we call it the head tie, to put some, you know. And he went and he tied her a head tie on. And he was so compassionate and gentle. And as a man, I was like, that's really touching. But he always cared and for his mom. And so both my parents and my mother, she always would send baskets. Every time we went grocery shopping, would be every 2 weeks. Back home, you pack to your pantry every 2 weeks or every month you do bulk shopping. My mom always had a basket for her mother. And so is that giving? She and my father never resented it. They know. She's buying this for, and that's for her mom. And so I think it was from that young age, it was instilled in us to give. My mother would give the last she has. Sometimes people, and I remember, people always thought I had so much when I was married young and had my own home. And people thought I had a lot. So this girl came one day and she asked me for some money to buy some sugar or something for a baby. And I remember it was the last $2 I had, and I gave it to her. And she, that's what she asked for. That was my last. I gave it to her. So I don't know. It's we grew up like that. And I must say my mom is a prayer. She used to pray for us. And she taught us about faith, believing in God. And so I have that strong faith. And I just, God is love. And I, when I do, I just love people. And I try to live that, the Christian values. I that's what I do. I remember in 1998, when I had an operation, I went to the hospital and I came out. I spent 5 weeks in the hospital. I almost died. And when I came out of there, I had a renewed sense of life. I just wanted to live and know that life is so precious. And that each day, I just want to touch somebody's life and just love them. Because I almost lost mine. And so, life is precious. And people don't realize that. A lot of people don't realize. One day at a time, and just enjoy it. Enjoy it, live it to the fullest. And share. The more you give, the more you get. And so everything, people come into my home. I always share. And thank God my husband is the same. If I send something for my father, he doesn't get upset. He's telling me he's the same. He will share with his family. And so we grew up like that, I think. My mom is a great inspiration for that. More so, because my mother used to make sure my father's mother had her share also. So my mom, and today I'm reflecting as I'm speaking to you. My mom, we used to fight a lot, but I'm a lot like my mother. It's amazing. It's amazing. It's amazing. She's gone. It'll be 5 years. In October, and you never know. It's like, wow, it's amazing. So that's life.
Well, Beverly, is there anything that you would like to add to the record that we didn't talk about today?
Basically, we talked about a lot. There's so much. My experience is so grand. I had a wonderful experience, and we're talking about people, black and white. I had a wonderful experience while I was in college. We had a student exchange program. It was the first adult students exchange program in the United States. We went to Scotland, and we had students from the College of New Rochelle going over to Scotland, and those students from St. Margaret College came here. So they came and we went, and we had a rich experience. And the funny thing is, they weren't exposed to blacks over there. And when they came here, they were very skeptical. And we started to formulate friendships, and writing, they went back, we wrote and stuff, and we went over to Scotland. And it was funny, one of the professors, she invited us to her home, and she had a cookout, and our children, they were so scared. It was, we had from the college blacks, from different, you know, colors. And we were getting along so well, and they were like looking at us like, who are these people? So I think we helped them. I remember talking to the professor, I said, I think the professors over there, Scottish professor, her husband and her children were uncomfortable. And people are looking and staring at us in the streets, you know, because we are all mixed up, black and white. And what came about, we had a rich experience in about learning about the culture of both societies. The experience that came, it's that color, no matter what color you are, we are the same inside. Because when we were about to leave, we had everybody crying, holding on to each other, because we bonded, and all that preconceived notions of blacks and whites and this and that. Well, they was gone. All the barriers were gone. And we just loved on each other. And I have pictures that those people are crying. And it was amazing. And so I just want people to know that no matter what color you're covered with, what hue you have, that the love is what matters most. And we have to just reach out to each other in love, because God is love. That's the bond. All He wants us to love each other. And if we genuinely love each other, then this world will be a better place. And that's what we hope for. Because I can go no matter where I go. My best friend happens to be white. And happens to be a woman I met when I was in Florida, when I was teaching in Florida. She was my assistant in my classroom. From Florida, I moved back. She's now in Columbia County. Wanted to come back to New York for many, many years and didn't. And she said, Beverly, I think you went to Florida for me. And that's what she said to me. And it's a rich experience when people, sometimes she's talking to people about her best friend. And then when they found out there's a black woman, they're, she's black. And that's the bottom line is color is just color. The bottom line is love is the answer. God is love. And that's what I want to say.
Well, thank you so much, Beverly, for your story and your thoughts
welcome.
Today.
You're welcome. It's a joy and a pleasure.
Thanks.
All right.
Goodbye.
Oh, my God.